Today is August 19th, 2006, and podcasting from the rocket ship. This is the weekly roundup of Mac Observer Podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro.
And I'm Jeff Gamet. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit us at macobserver.com/roundup.
Now, I want to know who says 60 hours a week is so long to work, particularly when you're making minimum wage. I mean, these people should be grateful.
Yeah, and someone from Lionsgate is getting fired.
Not just fired. These people are going to get rocked. There's going to be blood on the floor.
Most likely, yes. Apple's investigation into allegations that Foxconn mistreated employees that build iPods found that although workers put in more than 60 hours a week, there was no evidence of forced labor. Yeah, good for them. Based on Apple's code of conduct, employees can't work more than 60 hours in a week or 6 days in a row. Foxconn factory employees apparently make at least the local minimum wage, and Foxconn has agreed to implement a simpler pay scale to reduce confusion among its employees and to make it easier to track overtime. Apple's report indicates that two employees had been forced to stand at attention as punishment, and I think I've had to do worse. But it was an act that Apple found to be objectionable. In response, Foxconn has initiated new management employee training to help prevent similar acts in the future. And they've also brought in a third-party investigator, Virat, which has been contracted to investigate workplace health and safety. Apple also plans to audit the working conditions at every iPod and Mac assembly facility before the end of the year.
Now, apparently that report isn't good enough for the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, because its audit findings have not been independently verified. There's some joke in here somewhere about the Foxconn and the hen house. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but the group was concerned that Apple didn't specify what criteria were used to define unusual circumstances for working conditions. It also pointed out that Apple didn't ask employees if they would have preferred a different wage structure than the minimum wage plus overtime structure that's used in that factory.
And from iPod manufacturing onto iTunes partnerships, during the company's earnings call with investors and analysts last week, Lionsgate Entertainment confirmed Apple's iTunes movie plans. CEO John Feltheimer remarked, "We also have digital delivery deals in place with Cinema Now, Movie Link, and iTunes, with upcoming announcements with at least two more major industry players."
This is absolutely amazing to me. And another comment, President Steve Beeks said, "In terms of iTunes movie downloads, I think most likely sometime before the end of the year. We know when they're planning on launching, but since they have not announced it publicly, I do not think it is our place to say more about that." Not their place? How about not under their legal authority? Aren't these guys under NDA? This is amazing to me. It's also worth pointing out that all the rumors right now point toward a movie rental service rather than a movie purchasing service at iTunes.
Right. And meanwhile, Fox plans to launch its own movie and television show download service this October. Apparently, they're not so uptight about releasing their product roadmap. Movie downloading pricing hasn't been set yet, but you can expect it to be probably about $20. And Fox also plans to offer some of its television programming for download within 24 hours of the show's airing, just as it does on the iTunes Music Store. Each episode is going to be priced at about $1.99, and media at the store is expected to be encoded with Microsoft's Windows Media Player format, which means Mac users are out of luck.
And so is anyone who is using an iPod. By the way, there is a generation gap in movie-watching habits.
What do you mean? Like, not everyone watches movies the way I do?
No, apparently not. Today's teens and young adults, that includes me, you old man, are increasingly more interested in watching video content, even brand-new movies, on their computers, iPods, and cell phones. More than half of those surveyed by the LA Times would rather watch new movies at home than at a theater. Count me among the minority then. Dan Glickman, president of the Motion Picture Association of America, lamented the poll's results, saying, "You can't have a thriving movie industry without having a thriving theatrical business." That would be one of the dumber things I heard this week, at least one of the most short-sighted things I heard this week.
Mm-hmm. And finally in the news, music label EMI has struck a deal with Microsoft to preload the Zune Media Player with music videos. Microsoft Zune Player and download service are expected to hit the market in time for the holiday season.
We mentioned that story only because we talked about the rumors of Microsoft paying to replace songs purchased at the iTunes Music Store. At first blush, this version of the story sounds a lot like a replacement plan for that replacement plan. This is why you don't leak crazy ideas like this, because, of course, you get monkeys like me making fun when the crazy ideas don't come true.
Really?
Let's do the context machine.
Excellent.
All right, I want to begin with this story about sweatshop labor. We've talked about this on the Roundup before. Dave Hamilton was on the show talking. His argument was essentially that Apple has a responsibility to make money, a responsibility to its shareholders. And he was making the argument that if Apple walked away from low component pricing or low outsourcing pricing, that they would be doing a disservice to their shareholders. And he said, by the way, everybody does this. Everyone uses Chinese or other Asian labor that is underpriced and does not meet U.S. Work standards. First of all of that aside, and there are plenty of moral issues and discussions to be had there, I want to begin, just because this is my habit with a subject like this, with the most callous possible question. What is the likely effect to Apple's bottom line from all of this? What the stuff that we learn in this report that Apple released, is there going to be any effect on Apple's bottom line based on what we saw?
You know, I think the effect on their bottom line ultimately is going to be positive on this one, which goes contrary to what a lot of people are saying. But based on the fact that Apple went in right away, conducted their own investigation, and immediately revealed the results of that investigation once it was completed, and then turned around and said, oh, and by the way, we're going to go and check all of the different factories that make Apple products. So there. And I think that's going to turn out to be a really good and positive thing for Apple. And even though there's this negative press thing going on right now, in the long run, it's going to turn into a positive thing for Apple.
Now, I want to zero in on this point. What you're saying, I think, is that there is no material impact in terms of their component pricing, that there were no revelations in this that suggest that Apple's going to have to change suppliers or that its component prices are going to go up in order to continue to do business with Foxconn. It sounded like the changes would be fairly minor at Foxconn's end. Is that true?
I think so. Yet what they're looking at doing, based on Apple's report, they've changed how they disclose the pay structure to employees so that it's easier to understand. They're fixing some other things, like making some new facilities for people to live, giving the managers some training so they don't make people stand at attention anymore, things like that. So Foxconn's doing their part. Apple did their part with the investigation. And Apple's not going to go away from Foxconn and find someone else. As a matter of fact, there's rumors going around now that Foxconn may start making additional MacBooks for Apple. So, no, Apple's not going to abandon them.
Now, you hinted at some other issues here. They release this report. They go and they do their own audit. They release this report. They say, hey, we found some irregularities. We're going to get them fixed. And by the way, we're going to conduct this kind of investigation with all of our suppliers. That sounds to me like a PR maneuver. Is the PR side of this, you said, negative press right now, I suppose, in the sense that people are talking about the existence of sweatshop labor and in Apple's supply chain, but it seems overall, even today, that this is a pretty big PR coup for Apple, that they get to be seen as the people cleaning their own house and making sure that their own suppliers are good guys.
Absolutely. And I bet somewhere along the way, there's a PR person that's going to get a nice raise out of this.
All right. Now let's take a look. Well, the one other thing I want to ask you, are we done with this now? I mean, it seems to me there were some complaints that this report wasn't good enough, that it wasn't independently verified. My gut feeling when I look at this is that as far as most people are concerned, they're going to look at Apple's behavior and they're going to say, hey, they conducted this investigation. They allowed this to be a pretty public thing. They didn't try and squish it. I feel like most people are going to walk away from this story and lose interest in it. Do you think that the people out there saying, no, this isn't good enough, you got to zero in on these other things, do you think more is going to happen here, or are we pretty much done with this story?
I think for normal humans, we're pretty much done with the story. There are, however, some people out there that really are very upset about the whole investigation and the outcome. And they'll continue to beat their drums and be angry and speak openly about how unhappy they are. And the way I see it, that's okay. Let them go ahead and do that. That's, in most countries, that's their right to be able to go ahead and say what they feel about how Apple conducted the investigation and how they run their business. But I think ultimately, most people are going to sit back and look at this and say, okay, good for Apple for being transparent about all this. Let's go buy iPods.
All right. Now let's move on and talk about Lionsgate. This is astonishing to me that this happened. Let me ask the first question. How did this ever happen?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about how this possibly could have happened, and part of what goes around in my head says, wow, someone really needs to learn how to honor non-disclosure agreements. But then our editor-in-chief, Brian Chafin, today made a little comment that I sat back and went, oh, yeah, that's a good point. And his comment was, maybe they were required to disclose that information to their shareholders, and they were legally bound to say something, and they said everything they were required to and then stopped, which then gives us this ludicrous little string of comments that were made about, well, this is going to happen, but we can't talk about what we just talked about.
That is very interesting. I mean, it's an interesting point. You would think that that this is the sort of thing, I mean, if there is any company out there that knows how to write a non-disclosure agreement so that the things they don't want talked about don't get talked about, I would think that Apple is that company.
Right.
It's the thing that I find hard to believe. First of all, I suppose it's possible that the Lionsgate people weren't under NDA, that for some reason they forgot to send them the forms. That seems impossible to me. Right. I mean, can we agree that they must be one way or another under NDA?
We can so agree on that. Absolutely.
All right. Now, if we assume that Apple's good at this, that they do this all the time. I mean, Apple itself doesn't release. They say nothing about their product roadmap. They're a publicly held company. It seems, I suppose it's possible that there are elements here where they're forced to disclose things to shareholders. But at the same time, there was no real information in there. I mean, they said, yeah, we have distribution deals in place, but they didn't use that to explain, as far as I know, to explain any of their projections, to explain their financial behavior. Does that, I mean, at the end of the day, does this feel to you more like a really carefully crafted response, or does it feel to you like someone just wasn't thinking?
You know, I'm kind of leaning towards someone wasn't thinking, but I would like to think that if you are at the very top of the food chain in your company, you would be able to keep your mouth shut when appropriate. So I don't know.
It is amazing. Now, here's a logistical question. Apple, I assume, at this moment is in kind of a bind because if they're trying to solidify deals with movie studios, I wouldn't think that they'd want to go out right now and start suing their distribution partners. I mean, do you expect to see Apple go and you know, issue subpoenas to Lionsgate to get them to shut up or pay damages?
I doubt it. However, I bet that there's already been a closed-door meeting, and it was a very, very ugly thing. And, you know, there are certain situations where if Apple goes in guns blazing, it's going to backfire on them, and it's not going to look good at all. And this would be one of those times, because they need to be the happy, warm, fuzzy company right now so that they can get all these distribution deals with movie studios. And going in and publicly raking Lionsgate over the coals, that's not going to go over well. So that's one of those things that I'm sure has already happened in the privacy of their own homes, and that's where it'll end up staying.
Now, the one thing that does occur to me is that maybe after this deal is announced, whether it's 4 months from now, 6 months from now, sometime after that, you know, maybe next March, we'll quietly see reports of Apple suing executives at Lionsgate. Is there any possibility that once they have their deals in place and they've done their PR blitz and all of their responsibility to get the product out and get the product looking the way they want it to is taken care of, they'll go and they'll defend their NDAs? I mean, Apple has said repeatedly that it's a major part of their competitive advantage that they're so secretive, and they've defended that very vigorously. So I also find it hard to believe that they'll just let that go in the future, that they'll say, you know what, these people leaked, but they're important partners. We don't want to tick them off.
Well, I'm going to say no. Apple is not going to sue anyone at Lionsgate. But if we take your scenario where, like, next spring, things start quietly happening, maybe next spring that's when we see a couple executives quietly leaving Lionsgate. Now, another thing that could be going on here, and this is kind of a stretch, I know, but what about the possibility that Lionsgate was told, you need to say this during your conference call with your investors. Go ahead and tell them that we have our deal. And that's being done in order to let all the other studios know, look, we've already got Lionsgate. Why aren't you signed up? You're behind the game now.
Which is entirely possible. I mean, people leak information like this in a calculated fashion all the time. That's actually a really interesting idea. So anyway, it's a mess. We don't know exactly what's going on here, but it is incredibly unusual when you're talking about a product like this.
Yes.
Let's wrap up. I want to talk a little bit about this generation gap in the way people are dealing with media. The old generation gap was the CD buyers versus the music downloaders, the people who, you know, believed that media was a physical thing versus the people that went to Napster, the people who later went to the peer-to-peer networks to get their media. I am increasingly convinced that the current generation gap, or the developing generation gap, and the one that will persist much longer, is the one between subscription and ownership. And I've talked about this in the past. Dave Hamilton has been on the show, and Brian Chavin has been on the show, and both of them. Brian says, you know, I want to own my music. I really want to own my music. But at the same time, increasingly, I have the impression that kids aren't going to care much about owning their music. That whole thing about, you know, what's in your record collection? What's in your record collection? Kind of won't be there. People will just say, hey, I pay $10 a month, $15 a month, and I can listen to whatever I want. What's in my music collection? Everything. Do you think that that's where we're headed?
Maybe. But okay, here's a really sad thing. You said you remember this whole transition between the CD to the download. I remember when the generation transition was between records and CDs. How sad is that?
Where people were saying, no, you got to listen to it on vinyl. It sounds so much better.
Yes, and I actually remember having a conversation with a friend where I said, this is amazing. It's such a durable media. It's not going to scratch. It's not going to skip or hiss. And my friend says, never catch on. It'll never happen.
It's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere.
People don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, so anyhow, but back to the point at hand. I really hope we don't go to an all-subscription setup, because like Brian, I want to own my music. And I want to know that I don't have to go and re-download something 6 months from now that I've gotten rid of when I want to listen to it today. If I want to listen to a song 6 months or a year from now, I want to do that when I want to do it and not have to worry about the whole, is that in my current subscription set, and have I paid my monthly fees? And I don't want that. Now, on the other side of that coin, I'm sure that we're going to have a large audience of people that are perfectly fine merely subscribing to music. And that just breaks my heart. So what I think is more likely to happen, instead of everything going to just subscription, we will probably have a two-market system, at least for a while, where we have the pay services where you get to download and keep your music, and then we'll have the subscription services that work just as subscriptions.
So now I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about why exactly that breaks your heart. I get the impression that that's true for a number of people. I think that Brian would say similar things. Why, what is it that you feel lessens the experience of music, or lessens the marketplace for music, or the marketplace for the community around the art itself? Any number of those things. What gets damaged when you live in a subscription world?
Well, in the subscription world, you do have the scenario where you don't have all your music all the time. For many people, that's going to be okay. But for some people like me and Brian, that's not okay. All of my music should be here with me all of the time. And the idea of paying monthly so I can keep my music, to me, that leaves a very bitter taste in my mouth. I come from a world where you pay for your music, you take it home, and it's yours to listen to. And no one's going to come knocking on your door and say, okay, Mr. Gamut, you've listened to that CD for 30 days, give it back, or give us $15 more. And I don't want that guy coming to my door, taking my CD away, figuratively speaking.
When I think about this in terms of what gets lost, I guess in order for the thing that's connected to that is the idea that there's some song, for example, there's some song, some album, some handful of albums that you listen to constantly throughout your entire life. And
sure.
I have, you know, a handful that I could rattle off that are that way for me. And those are the things that you don't want someone to walk away with. I guess the image that's in your head is that subscription goes with disposable music. Because you don't
Yes.
care, you don't care so much about which songs you happen to have on your computer at any given time. You just want to be able to choose which songs. You say, hey, I heard this song on the radio, I'm going to go download it. And then when you get bored of it, you throw it out and you download some other stuff that you've been hearing on the radio. Is that kind of what's bothering you about it, that it seems closely tied to disposable music?
Oh, very much so. And, you know, if you take the subscription music service, the way I would find it to be a palatable thing, and I'm using palatable as a relative term here, would be not so much as a music download, but more like cable television, where I pay a monthly fee and I can turn on any channel anytime I want and just watch whatever's on. Okay, why don't you give me that with music? And then I have my download service that I'm buying all my music from, and then I have my cable type subscription where I listen to whatever station I want to listen to at any time. That to me would be a more reasonable way to do it, because then I'm also taking the whole idea of, well, I don't own this music that I'm listening to, and it's not going to be on my computer forever. And we're taking it a step farther and saying, here you go, just listen to whatever style of music you want, whenever you want, just another streaming radio station. You just happen to pay for it instead of getting it for free. And yes, I know we already have services like that, and to the best of my knowledge, they seem to be doing well. So why not, let's just compromise here, and let's keep those paid streaming services, and we'll keep our music downloads that we get to keep when we download them, and call it a day.
And of course, the key here, the real question, is one of consumer choice, which is what you're talking about. And I think one of the reasons the perception of choice is that there is no choice is because the various services don't work together. If you buy songs on iTunes, you can't listen to them on the same music player that you subscribe to songs through, say, Rhapsody.
Not without a couple extra steps. You are correct. Yes.
And we'll have to leave it there. If you have any questions, comments, thoughts about the news, you can send emails, whatever. We love hearing from you guys about what you think about what we're doing here. So send us your comments. We got some really interesting stuff last week about Time Machine and backup options, particularly networked backup options, partnership between Apple and Google. Send us stuff. We love hearing that stuff. The email address is roundup@macobserver.com, and that'll get to both Jeff and to me.
Okay, let's wrap up with product roundup.
All right. Well, Apple released an update to Boot Camp, its utility that lets you boot Windows XP on an Intel-based Mac, on Tuesday. Boot Camp 1.1, it's still in beta, lets you, among other things, install Windows XP on any internal disk, which is very exciting for me. Like I said, we're on the rocket ship right now, and I'll talk about this probably on the Geek Gab, I think, in a little while, but I'm running off a new Mac Pro, so it's got some quirky stuff right now. We're still figuring out exactly how to transition the show to it, but very exciting. And I like the fact that if I get a second internal hard drive in this guy, that could be dedicated to a Windows disk. Very exciting.
Yes. Now, TIGSOFT announced the media availability of Convertit 3.0 on Monday. And Convertit is a unit measurement conversion application. It's priced at $24.95.
Logitech announced the two new stereo iPod speaker systems on Thursday, the Audio Station and the Audio Station Express. The former, which costs $300, is a home stereo replacement. The latter, at $130, is a mobile iPod speaker system.
And Newer Technology announced the immediate availability of high-capacity batteries for Apple's 12-inch G4 iBook on Thursday. They're priced between $100 and $130, and they are also compatible with the G3 iBook.
All right. WeebyTech announced on Tuesday that it has improved the write block technology it uses in its forensic notebook DriveDock V4. Seems like a very complicated name. The improved DriveDock supports imaging 2.5-inch drives while prohibiting any information from being written back to the disk. It costs $400.
And finally this week, Misha Sakapurulo reviews iKitty and the Tune Deck for the iPod Nano.
And poor Misha. It's Sakapurulo.
You know, and let me give my public apology to Misha right now, because no matter what I do, I pronounce his last name differently every single time I say it. Misha.
And we were talking about it at the beginning of the show. It's just... it's one of those names. It took me actually several weeks. I think Sakapurulo is what I called him for a few weeks at the beginning of the show. But eventually your tongue gets around it, and then Misha stops sending you hate mail.
You know, maybe what I could do is have Misha send me a nice little digital recording of his name, and every time I need to say it, I'll just press a little button on my Mac, and you'll hear his voice saying his name, and I'll continue on.
That's the worst idea I've ever heard. That's the news. Yeah. Thanks for listening to the Weekly Roundup. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. And remember, the Podcast Expo is coming up September 29th and 30th. I will be there. I hope that all of you are. Yeah.
Send us your thoughts and comments to roundup@macobserver.com. We do want to hear what you have to say, and please stay subscribed.
Until next week, we'll see you online.